This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, public affairs programming brought to you in part by Flying Dog Media. For your next website design, visit flyingdogmedia.com. The two legislators who represent Charlottesville and Albemarle County in the Virginia House of Delegates come from opposite sides of the aisle, but they came together Wednesday evening for a dialogue with constituents during a program sponsored by the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, held at the Community Chalkboard and Podium. The following is the complete program from that event, moderated by Jane Foy of WINA's morning program.
Had a long conversation with my colleague, Mr. Chris Callahan here from WINA, when I was asked to do this. And when you think of what two voices from the Charlottesville, Albemarle area can do in Richmond, when there are 100 voices for the House of Representatives, the General Assembly's House of Representatives, and there are 50 voices in the Senate. So these, 40, thank you. These are two voices who go to Richmond for us. So if we don't make it very clear what our voice is and what we want to, the message we want to take to Richmond, we only have these two people to do it, so we have to make it very clear. Charlottesville is a very influential but very small portion of this state. We are very fortunate enough to have these two gentlemen representing us in Richmond. But if we want our voices to be heard, we have to make sure that they understand what it is that we want. And I think it's important that we make that very clear to them so that they know what they're doing and what and who they're representing when they go to Richmond. David Toscano earned his BA from Colgate University, his PhD from Boston College, and his law degree from UVA. He's a practicing attorney here in Charlottesville and a former sociology professor at James Madison University. A veteran in Charlottesville politics, he served as mayor from 1994 to 1996 and as a city councilor for 12 years until 2002. He was elected to the House of Delegates in 2006, where his committee assignments include Courts of Justice, Science, and Technology. Rob Bell earned both his undergraduate degree and law degree from the University of Virginia. He, too, is a practicing attorney in Charlottesville. Previously, he served as prosecutor in Orange County as the assistant Commonwealth's attorney. He was first elected to his seat in 2001. His current committee assignments are Courts of Justice, Health, Welfare, and Institutions, Privileges, and Elections. And I might say that I'm very proud to say that both of these gentlemen are regular guests on our WINA morning show. We're always delighted to have them. They are candid, they are accessible, and we're delighted to have them here tonight. I would ask you to think of your questions for them. Both of the gentlemen have expressed to me that they would like to answer your question, and then if you have a follow-up comment or an additional question, please feel free to keep the conversation going. With your indulgence, I'd like to start with the first question, and that is this. The noise of politics is so deafening that we can't hear the issues any longer. And that is not just between parties, it's within parties. How can we, in your opinion, quell the noise of politics so we can concentrate on the issues at hand? Rob, would you take the first question, or the answer first, please?
I want to thank everybody for coming out. This is sort of a neat opportunity to celebrate the First Amendment. I have the terrific honor of holding Thomas Jefferson's seat in the General Assembly. If you look at a long list of people that have held it, way up at the top is Thomas Jefferson. Of course, way, way down at the bottom is me. But it's a real honor to do that. And it's nice to be here and have what I hope is an open dialogue. And I think this would be, for instance, a good question to hear what you all think, because David and I are in the middle of it every day. And it's you sometimes feel like you're drowning. The water is very deep. It's hard to get a perspective. You spend each day trying to get the mail answered and the phone calls returned and, you know, prepare for the next bill. And we might not be the best people to have a long view of this. I fear that this wall might be 25 years too late, in a good way and in a bad way, that we no longer need a wall. Nowadays, and I'm referring to sort of the effects of the Internet and blogs and websites and YouTube and the rest of it, It is easier than ever before, probably in ever before, for any one of us to publish everything we think within 20 minutes of thinking it and having anyone who wants to see it, see it. And I'm interested in high-tech stuff, and so I kind of watched as this came on, and I had pretty high hopes that as this happened, it would, frankly, remove Bob Gibson and Chris Callahan and Jane Foy from the middle, and it would make it easier for people who might feel intimidated about calling into a radio show or writing a letter to the paper from contacting us. I thought this would make it easy and actually would actually elevate the debate, and maybe that'll happen before we're done, but right now I think if you look at the impact of this instantaneous communication, it has been just the opposite. I'm afraid that what you're describing is true. And there's a new book out. Joe Klein wrote the book, and I forget the title. Somebody might remember it. But it's about the coarsening of American politics. And his theory is that with cheaper communications plus nonstop polling, we really are worse off. Because the question is, every generation says things are worse off than they were a generation ago and a generation ago. His theory is actually that they're worse, that if you look at a bunch of indices, that politics now is coarser, uglier, less light, more heat than it's ever been before. I don't know, Jane. There are times you catch me on a bad day, and I'll say that I don't think there is an answer. I do think that we are unusually fortunate here. This kind of event would not work probably in 80 of the 100 districts. You wouldn't have people willing to dialogue at all. And so in some ways, we're not the right people to be asking. And certainly the people that are here are not the right people to ask because they're here. But I'm not sure what the...
When you run into that kind of behavior in Richmond, and we know that you have, and we've heard it, and I think, frankly, most of us are really tired of it, is there something that you can do to say to a party member, a colleague, that says, this does not advance the people's business, if you don't mind?
Let me answer, then I'll turn it over to Dave, just so I don't hog the mic.
What? His turn.
Well, I mean, here's the problem, and I was thinking about this today on a different topic. I was answering some mail today, and I've got a stack, about 60 or 70 letters I've gotten in the last month. And of that 60 or 70, about 3 of them think I'm smart, and 67 think I'm foolish. And what happens is people say they want leadership. Everybody says, we want a leader. We don't want somebody who's just putting his finger in the air and following the polls. But the moment you do something that is unpopular or that they don't want, they fuss and say, that's not what we told you to do when you're not following us. And so I concluded that what most people really want, I'm one of them, I'm not fussing at anybody, but what most people want is they want the leader to stand up against everyone else when it's in support of what they really want. And I think that the missing link in the chain is the willingness to accept that on this issue, we may disagree, but you are still a thoughtful person, and I agree with you on 70% of things, and that's going to be pretty good. I gather that used to be the dynamic. It's not the dynamic anymore. Now it really is, if you're not with us 20 times out of 20, you're a rat and a fink. And I think that's what's leading to some of the problems that we have.
I think you're right. David, how do you feel about that?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for holding this event. It's nice to be down at the wall after it took so long to get it done. But I'll tell you, I had a friend from Northern Virginia, a delegate friend, come down here. I showed him around. He came up to this place, and boy, he was so enthused to see this wall. He said, this is a great tourist attraction. So hopefully there'll be a lot of people who come down, take a look at it, use it. Rob and I are the two successors to Jefferson's seat. Actually, when Jefferson served in the House of Delegates, he represented Albemarle County. Charlottesville was not a city. Charlottesville was a town. But Charlottesville was right in the center of Jefferson's representation. So we are the two successors, and we're glad to take on that mantle. I think it's events like this that tend to break down some of the partisan bickering that you see. And I think it would be events like this that would break down even the infighting within parties, because there's a lot of that that goes on, too. There are true believers within each party. And unfortunately, sometimes the noise of the true believers drown out the folks who want to take a more moderate course to try to get certain things done for the good of the public. I can suggest a couple of things. One of the things... I was thinking a couple weeks ago, listening to public radio, and in the evening, after Coy's show, And I think Bob, I think it was Bob's show, Bob Gibson's show, and he had Dave Nutter on, who's a Republican from Blacksburg, from the House of Delegates, and Brian Moran, who's the House Democratic Caucus leader out of Alexandria. And I was listening to these two guys, and they were actually having a conversation, which was the first conversation I had heard, really, between Republicans and Democrats since I had been elected to the House of Delegates. What happens down in Richmond is, unfortunately, in my view, just before a session starts, the Republicans get in their caucus, the Democrats get in their caucus, they'll have some debates within their respective caucuses, and then they come out and they vote their caucuses. Generally speaking, I tend to think, with all due respects, Rob, that that's more a Republican approach than a Democratic approach. We generally don't bind our caucus. I think that there was a lot of binding going on. You can tell us about the internal stuff later on in the Republican caucus in this last session. But, you know, we've got to get beyond that. We've got to allow people to vote their consciences. They always won't agree with the respective parties, and that'll be a good thing. The other thing that we need to do, I think, is we need to move towards nonpartisan redistricting. One of the biggest mistakes we have in this country is those people who are in control of the legislature and the legislative process at the time that redistricting gets accomplished controls the drawing in the districts. And so what you do is you create a whole slew of safe seats. What that does is kick off a dynamic in the safe seats where the party zealots control the process of who gets nominated. That tends to push the more moderate voices to the side and tends to create districts where extremes tend to dominate. And I think you're seeing that especially in portions of the House of Delegates. There are too many safe seats in the House of Delegates right now. Now, try to get our colleagues on the other side of the aisle to agree to a nonpartisan redistricting. You know, I wasn't in the House of Delegates when the Democrats controlled the scene. I'd like to think that I would have supported nonpartisan redistricting at that time. I hope the Republican Party can embrace that because I think it's best for the Commonwealth of Virginia.
All right. Thank you, David. Would anyone like to comment on the comments the two delegates just made, or do you have a question? Yes, ma'am. I don't think this will go to you, but
I think I can be heard.
You can be heard.
I'm Martha Wood. I'm past president of the Virginia Education Association, retired, and I'm here to ask you to to make a comment to you about a bill which was before you and passed out of the House and the Senate to make equitable the health care credit that teachers get from the Virginia retirement system that is similar to what the state employees and municipal employees get. It didn't make it out of the budget process. So I'm asking that you again support that bill in the name of parity with state employees for retired public educators as well. You represent, both of you probably represent somewhere close to 1,000 in your two districts of retired public school teachers, and they're the majority of the people who are covered by this issue. For those of you who are not familiar with this program, it has to do with a credit which is given the members of the Virginia retirement system. State employees get $4 per month per year of service. Public school teachers get $2.50 per month per year of employment. And we're asking that the public school teachers allotment be raised to be on parity with the state employees. I know you've heard me say this before, but I want to emphasize that this year it's really important that we make sure that stays in the budget.
Those monies that you are referring to, does that go toward the teacher's retirement?
It goes toward their health care insurance in retirement. Many of them are paying $700 a month for their health care insurance because they're They don't work for Albemarle and Charlotte still that allow them to stay in their system. But they're still having to pay their premium, and that's a very large expense for these folks. And we believe that they should have parity with state and municipal employees.
Thank you.
Could I just ask a clarifying? Are there any, obviously teacher pay comes from state and local sources. Did the local sources have anything to do with this, or is this entirely the state retirement that we're talking about?
That's part of this bill, is to put that money back into the allotment from VRS. Currently, it is shared by the local school systems and by the state. But it should be, and that was done several years ago during the previous administration as a means of balancing the budget. It needs to go back where it was, and that's part of the legislation which made it out of both houses of the General Assembly this year. It just needs to stay in the budget. That was one of the victims at the very end.
David, please.
It's interesting because as we went through the budget process, and actually that was one of the good things that happened out of this session, was we got a pretty good budget. If you put transportation to the side, we ended up with a good budget. There's a lot of money in the budget for public education, so I'm going to try to find out more why that particular item got left out. Initially, in the budget was a 3% raise for teachers. We argued early in the session it should be raised to 4%. We weren't able to prevail in the first stage of the budget, but toward the end of the budget, when there was some more money available, there was an extra 1% put in for teacher raises. That was a good thing. So I'm sort of puzzled as to why this particular item got left out, and we'll try to take a look at that and find out.
I can't tell you why it was left out. I applaud the fact that for active teachers, an increase of the state share of their salary was made. It begins halfway through their salary year, but that's a good place to start. I just think that retirees who contribute a great deal to the economy need to have that extra help.
Thank you. Rob, would you like to comment on this as well? No? Yes, sir. Can you be heard, or would you like to come up here and use the microphone? Okay. And, just tell you where, what part of Virginia you're from.
I can do that. I'm Peter Kleeman. I live about two blocks from here in Charlottesville. And I'd like to just respond on some of the partisan issue. I know we in Charlottesville have now gone to an election of school board officials as a nonpartisan election, and people are saying that going to a nonpartisan election is a good thing and are opposing the idea of these being partisan elections. I'm just curious, by extension, do you think there's any value to having perhaps city council elections as being nonpartisan, perhaps delegate elections as being nonpartisan, and what the benefits of doing that might be? I know most people won't go to a grocery store and shop and pick among products if there's only two choices on the shelf. So if we can expand the choices and we can have a better, in fact, polling of the public as to what their issues are and how they choose to vote, I think we can learn a lot more about where the public stands on issues and have people represent them than saying there's only choices and you either are a Republican or you're a Democrat. So I'm curious as to what you might think about those issues.
Would you like to take that, Rob,
sure.
First?
Mr. Kleeman, I don't have any objection. If partisan means having strong views or that you feel some heartfelt things, I don't think every issue should be decided in what would be called sort of a I do think you can expect us to do certain things based on what we tell you. I don't think we should just send a bunch of people down to Richmond without telling us sort of what we believe and just kind of hoping that it works out. So that's sort of one extreme. On the other hand, I think that the larger question is, should it be easier for people, let's say not nonpartisan, but additionally partisan, or other parties? So let's say that you are the most obvious one would be the Greens or the Libertarians. Those are two parties that have sort of a constellation of issues that they don't believe are being adequately addressed by either major party. Should they be able to run? Around here, for the delegates, it's fairly easy. And so I can remember gosh, as recently as I remember when Ed Robb and Emily Kirk ran against each other, there were two candidates. In fact, they were both. There was both a Libertarian and a Green candidate. I can't recall it in my race. No, in neither of my races has there been a third-party candidate. But I don't know what the requirements are, but it's obviously relatively easy. Now, whether that's a socially good thing is a sort of neat and complicated question. There are certainly political systems like Italy where it's much more common to have more than two parties. And if you look at over sort of the post-war Italian history, there's some trade-offs. I think that you can vote more precisely for the person you think is exactly the one you want, but Israel might be a better example. What you do have is often, far from having a less partisan system, you often have a relatively small party being the balance of power, and they actually are more powerful than it might be. And America now has had, since the Whigs, essentially a two-party system where, as new ideas come forward like the populists did in the 20s, the parties eventually co-opted. And one of the parties will say, well, that's an important idea. We will take some of those ideas and put it into our party. I don't whether one of those is automatically better than the other, I don't know. But that's sort of the choices we have. I don't have any objection, though, to third-party candidates running. I think that they often help raise issues that we might not be so quickly knowledgeable about.
David?
Well, I think some of you know that I have had a little experience with third-party candidacies, and a long time ago. But, you know, the value of bringing new ideas into the mix, I think, is important. I think that the more you get into local races, the less powerful the argument is for partisan races. I think as you start to move up in the House of Delegates races or Senate races, I think there is a value to having partisan elections, and I think that the parties stand for different things. And I think that usually folks who get the nominations run on those general principles. You know, for Democrats, I like to think we're the party of economic opportunity, and that we're the party that wants to spread economic opportunity to the broadest cross sections of Americans. We're the party of choice, and Rob could go through and he could list what he would think the Republican Party stands for. And sometimes it's good to have those contrasts where people can take a look and look at the values, look at the philosophies, and make a choice. I think it's more problematic at the local level because I think so many of those issues don't really lend themselves to partisan solutions. And as running three times for city council, I can tell you, even though it was Democrat on the list that I was running under, you know, I was talking about things that weren't necessarily consistent with what the National Democratic Party thought. So I guess in conclusion, I think we got to find a better way to get more ideas in the mix and to involve more people in the process. And if that's through third-party candidacies or other people running as independents, well, you know, so be it. That's probably not a bad thing.
Would you like to use the microphone?
This is actually a question for Delegate Bell specifically.
Tell us where you're from.
Oh, sorry. My name is Brian Bills. I am from Delegate Bell's district. I live out on Broomley Road out west of town. This is a question for Delegate Bell specifically regarding your support for the so-called marriage amendment coming up on the ballot in November. It's written very broadly in such a way as to regard contracts between unmarried individuals. And one of the side effects of this is that single victims of domestic violence are going to, under this amendment, be unable to get restraining orders and unable to apply for the services that apply to victims of domestic violence. So I was wondering if you had any plans to restore those rights to single victims of domestic violence.
The issue he's addressing is the marriage amendment to the Constitution, which will be on the ballot this fall. And did everybody hear? I don't want to recast it in a way that probably you'd say I didn't get accurately. The concern is that will it have an effect beyond marriage itself? I don't think so. I'm aware, obviously, and this was raised when we were looking at the wording, that there's a concern that it will have a broader sweep than marriage. Now, as I see the world, there are the people who don't want it no matter what, that just think it's a bad idea from the get-go. There are, and I understand that they don't like the way it's worded. They wouldn't like however it's worded. There's a second group that wouldn't mind a ban on gay marriage, but think that this is too broad. And I'm not asking you to tell us which you are, but that may be a second group. And there's a third group that thinks that the ban is okay as it's worded. We looked at this, and I can't tell you how a court will interpret it. the issue you're raising was raised in Ohio, and that's sort of where it's come up. And the wording as it currently has, an awful lot of us have looked at it, some pretty good lawyers, without trying to categorize our quality levels, don't think that that's going to happen. Now, if you believe that that's going to happen from reading the amendment, then obviously you should vote against it, because it would apply, if under that reading, to all sorts of things. But that is not the way they have been interpreted any place but Ohio, and even then just in one lower court that's since been overturned. So I understand the concern. I simply don't share it. I understand the concern. I don't think it's properly going to be brought up by the amendment. I understand what you're saying, though.
David, would you like to address this?
Sure. I had the opportunity to vote against putting this on the ballot, I don't know, five times during this. How many times we vote on this thing? There were a lot of times I voted on this. I think the concern that a lot of us have is just exactly what you expressed, Brian, that it goes too far. And I think it's important to understand some of the background of the legislative process. There are some of us who argued that we shouldn't move too fast on this amendment. We should take our time and get the wording right. But that argument fell on deaf ears, and that was really the first bill that was pushed through the legislature in this session. It came up in the first week, if I'm not mistaken. And the reason why people didn't want to take a step back and look at the wording is that if you changed the word, any word in the amendment that got passed to be put on the ballot in the fall, it had to go through a process that would take you through two legislative sessions. And some folks who had made promises to their constituents that they were going to support putting in a marriage amendment to the Constitution on the ballot felt like they couldn't back away from that. And even though there might have been some consternation about how far-reaching this amendment was, those folks felt like they had to go forward and pass it. I don't think that it's a good amendment. I think it's too broad. I think it enshrines discrimination in the Virginia Constitution. There are already a number of laws prohibiting gay marriage in the state of Virginia. I didn't think we needed to take it any step farther, and that's why I didn't support the amendment. It'll be interesting to see, with all the forces marshaling their money this fall, how it's all going to turn out. I think every state where it's been on the ballot, a similar kind of amendment like this, I think it's passed everywhere. So I would expect it probably will pass in Virginia.
Now, the next step for this, though, is with the electorate. It is going to be an amendment on the ballot. So there will be no further discussion with this session of the General Assembly.
And I mean, just to be clear, I mean, this is why we do referenda. Recent ones have included unimportant things and important things. If this is something that you feel strongly about, this is a chance. I mean, if it doesn't pass Virginian voters, it won't pass. I mean, it's a constitutional amendment. So this would be a real opportunity if you feel that, as often people do, that we're knuckleheads down in Richmond, this is a chance to get it, I mean, to make sure that what we did doesn't happen.
Does anyone else have a question? Would you like to use the microphone? Lady, I'm sorry, I was pointing to the lady in the blue. Would you like to come up and use the microphone? Or you can yell. It's up to you entirely.
I basically have two questions. I'm Karen Pape, and I'm in David Toscano's district. I'd like to ask you to educate me, if you would, and explain to me what a binding caucus is, and also if... Mr. Bell could tell me what would be the repercussions if he chose to not abide by the Republican caucus.
Two great questions. The way it works is right now there are 57 Republicans in the House of Delegates and how many Democrats? 40 Democrats, okay. And so what we do is we get together in caucuses, the Republicans and the Democrats, and we discuss issues, especially bills that are about to hit the floor of the House of Delegates in that particular day. To bind a caucus means you take a vote in the caucus that says that we all have to vote the same way on that particular bill. So you march out, and if the Republicans bind their caucus, it's all over with, because they've got 57 votes. they're going to be able to prevent any bill from being passed or push any bill through. Now, this has happened on a number of occasions, and we can go into some concrete examples where this has occurred, and some of which got me fairly upset. But that's maybe for the latter part of the discussion. To go against your caucus could have some pretty critical political implications. Very early in this session, a rule was passed changing the rules of the House that allowed the Speaker of the House to take people off of committees or move them from one committee to another whenever he wanted to. This was very new. Some people were conjecturing that that was a way to try to enforce party discipline, especially on the Republicans. Rob might want to comment because I've never asked him about this, but that was the theory that some people on my side of the aisle had. None of that ever happened because nobody really went outside the caucus when the caucus was bound. But there could be ramifications for somebody going outside. There have been ramifications on some people who took votes against the Republican position 2 years ago. They got party challenges in primaries. They weren't all supported, those challengers, by the Republican Party, but they did get challenges.
Rob, would you like to respond?
Yeah, if I understand it. In practice, and I don't know, we can talk about the theory. In practice, they are a unusual mechanism primarily for what I call big votes. And so in my tenure, I've been there 5 years, there have been maybe a half dozen. So it's not something that happens a lot. The most obvious examples are the budget. And I think everybody, whether you like it or not, can understand how 100 different people can't each write the budget. And what happens is an agreement that this is going to be the best it's going to be, and we've got to get a budget each year. And goodness, in my 5 years, we've had trouble two times anyway. So it's hard enough to get 51 votes on a budget, period, even if it's not just what you want, even if it's been some money in Lynchburg that I'd rather see in Charlottesville or not spend at all. You have to support it. And that's sort of the general idea behind a caucus position. The larger idea about discipline within a caucus is interesting. I think that what you see if you are politically, historically minded is, over time, our legislature is just like Congress, only smaller. I mean, you can see a lot of parallels. Ours is the same size as the Senate. We don't have a big house. But to get anything done with 100 egotistical know-it-alls like politicians takes some discipline, some ability to make the team move. And the Speaker, and this probably comes from speakers gone by, calls it herding cats. It is trying to get the cats into one place just long enough to vote. And if you watch us on the floor, you will see that every one of us has three things we think we're doing that are more important. So we're always calling someone back home or looking up for our bill or preparing to speak or calling a press conference or answering mail. And what you have is over time, sometimes it's called centralized or decentralized authority. Sometimes it gets very decentralized where everybody kind of just does their own thing and you just kind of hope things come together. And candidly, that's when voters get frustrated and say, y'all are a do-nothing Congress. Nothing is happening. Nothing's getting passed. So then the power re-centralizes, and the Speaker gets more power and has the ability to force us to do votes that maybe aren't our favorite votes. And then people say, gosh, you're marching in lockstep. What a bunch of Nazis you are. And it's not Democratic or Republican. LBJ had one of the best whip organizations, and I read a neat biography of him where he once went to a senator and made him vote in a way that would cost him his seat. Not might cost him a seat, but would absolutely cost him a seat. It would be, I don't know, for instance, if I had to vote to abolish UVA, literally to abolish it, just to shut it down and use the buildings for, another company. And LBJ was proud of this story and told this story, not because it just that it cost the guy the seat, but it showed everyone else just how powerful he was, how he was able to exert his will on the body and get them to do what he wanted. He's thought to be the most effective speaker or Senate majority leader in recent history by political scientists. And so we go back and forth. And so I think that in my tenure, we had I wasn't there for the Democrats, so I understand they've had their own sort of cycles of real centralized power and other times that they didn't. We had Vance Wilkins, who was a fairly centralized, he kind of helped a lot of us get elected and he kept a lot of his cards close to his vest and expected us to, on when he told us to, we needed to vote. When he fell, and we might remember there was a sexual scandal involving him, he fell. the new speaker came in, and at least for the first couple of years, it wasn't so centralized. And frankly, you could either think that's great because a lot of the bills you liked got through, or you might think it's awful because you had some other bills that just never got a hearing, never got 51 votes. I think it's fair to say that in the last 2 years, he has had a more direct impact on the bills that he cares about. Now, it may seem very controlling outside. I think that if he were here, Speaker Howell would say, gosh, I get about 5 bills I want each year out of the 2,000, and the rest of them I just have to let the inmates run the asylum. That's all I get to do. But they are the big bills. I mean, I think it's fair to say he has a big impact on the budget, the big impact on the 3 or 4 other signature bills that you see. So that's sort of the trade-offs. You asked about what might happen. I think what happens is the caucus has, it's clear to say that the majority caucus, more than the minority caucus, but the majority caucus has plums, and basically it's the good committees. There are some prestige committees, and there are some that, frankly, aren't so good. The prestige committees handle more important bills. They include the money committees, the appropriations committee, commerce and labor, which has all of the banking bills, just some very important commercial bills. And then some of the other ones that you could guess just handle, I mean, 4 or 5 bills. Courts of Justice is a very important committee, but you, because the lawyers get onto it, I got onto it as a freshman, Dave got onto it as a freshman. But what you can do, I think, is that the team says, listen, we need, if you want to get one of the plums, we expect you to take some hard votes once in a while. I think that's what sort of the effect would be. I've got mid-level committees, and so I'm both less, I've got fewer plums, but less they can take away. So if you look at my votes, I think that I call it a mainstream voting, which is not, I'm not one of the 20 people that always vote in lockstep, but I'm also not one of the people that are running off, always doing his own thing.
Do we have another question from the audience? Yes, ma'am. Did everybody hear that? The lady is asking, based on a question from her colleague who's Venezuelan American, the delegate's opinions on all of the recent headlines about immigration, illegal and otherwise. David, do you want to take that first?
Sure. There were a number of immigration bills introduced in the House and the Senate. I remember 3 very distinctly because I was in the minority each time when these bills got passed, and in each case, they were taking away the ability of immigrants to access, presumably illegal immigrants, to access services. The ones that I was most concerned about were access that children might get to services. And I've always taken the position that we shouldn't penalize children for something that their parents do. There were also some bills introduced that would have prevented, quote, illegal immigrants and their children from getting access to certain universities and colleges. And I felt strongly that we shouldn't be supporting that position as well. Now, I'm not sure if all of those got through. Because the Senate, you know, the way it works is the House, there are bills introduced in the House and they're passed in the House and they go over to the Senate and they may never be passed by the Senate. If they're not passed by the Senate, they're killed, they're dead. Or the Senate might amend them and send them back to the House and then we can either amend or not. And then the governor can always veto these things. But the big immigration bills I was in the minority on, because I was concerned about taking away folks' rights.
I think this is probably something where Dave and I do have a different approach. And just at the top, a lot of the bills that you probably have read about are not these bills. Those are the bills up in Washington's Congress, and whatever Dave and I think about Washington's bills, we don't have much. They don't much care what we think. They don't ask us for opinions, and so our impact is pretty modest. The specific bills with regards to state benefits and higher ed benefits are the most obvious. I see it a little differently. I see it as a limited resource. Now, it's not an absolutely limited resource. We can always increase the size of the pie by spending more money. But to the extent there's a limited resource and to the extent there's so many seats at UVA or so many seats at James Madison or so many seats at George Mason, I am troubled by the idea that we would give those seats to the child of an illegal immigrant over the child of a person who is an American citizen. And so as those bills came on, I try and take them up one by one, but that has been my general approach.
Thank you.
Since we're having a dialogue, can you give me some insight about the caucus position on that? Was there a caucus position on those bills?
Okay.
Do you remember?
I don't remember, but the answer was no. I don't.
Questions from the audience. This is a gentleman here in the blue shirt. Would you like the microphone, sir? Tell us which part of Virginia you're from.
Thank you. I live in the city of Charlottesville, so Mr. Toscano is legally my representative, although not philosophically. I can understand why Mr. Toscano wants to whine about redistricting in the 1990s. He wouldn't have whined about it because his party, from roughly the middle of the 1880s until the 1991 redistricting, controlled redistricting in Virginia. And there was never an effort by the Democrats to say, oh, let's go to a nonpartisan or to a bipartisan or to some sort of judicial redistricting. I noticed that Mr. Van Yeres is in the audience. You never saw Mr. Van Yeres from the 81, the 82, or the 91 redistricting saying, oh, no, we don't want to do it here in the General Assembly. These things have been political since essentially the founding of the country. And so I'm wondering what the two delegates, obviously we seem to know what Mr. Toscano thinks, but what Mr. Bell thinks of what would be the benefits of going to a nonpartisan system or an allegedly nonpartisan system like they have in Iowa.
You know, this... I sit on the committee, so I might actually get a chance. We'll see if I'm still there under the speaker's new rules in 5 years. But let me just say what my position is, and anybody can comment on it if they wish. We now have software so that anyone in this audience can present a plan. Okay, and I'm not being funny. It's Excel with some map making software. Any one of you can submit a plan. And in 2012, whoever is the majority party in the House will pass a plan out. Now, the Democrats might be in control. They might be in control of the Senate. They might have the governor's mansion. I don't have any idea where this is all going to go. I think that nonpartisanship is a value, but I think what people are getting at is not the nonpartisanship. I think they're getting at the competitiveness of the seats. I think that's the if you sort of drill down why they think it would be helpful, I think that's what they're saying. That's a value, but I don't think it's the only value. And I'll be real specific and give you some good examples. Charlottesville is the second most Democratic locality in the state. It trails only Petersburg. When we're talking about safe seats, the safest seat by a very wide margin in this area is Dave's. The only way to make Dave's competitive, if you look at a map, is what we call pizza slicing. And this is not real high sophistication. Let me explain it. The city has a bunch of Democrats. They're surrounded by... not particularly red Albemarle County, but once you get out to Greene and Madison County, Orange County, you get to pretty Republican areas. The only way that you will ever make the city of Charlottesville a competitive district is to pizza slice. You would go in with you'd get a fourth of the city, you'd march all the way out to Madison till you got to 80,000 votes. That would be what the districts would look like. You'd probably have to split it four ways. You probably would have to have four slices of the pizza, but you might have to have five because Albemarle County is growing very quickly and a lot of the new people that are moving in are not Republican. And so if you were trying to come up with a competitive seat, that's what it would look like. Now, that is, in fact, what we're talking about. And let's get away from high theory. That is, in fact, what a competitive Charlottesville would be like. Now, that may be worth... That may be good. In other words, we may think that is a good thing, that you would have this sort of strange districts and each of us would have three or four localities we'd have to represent the rest of it. I don't know. I understand what the advocates are asking for. I share some of your, I wonder sometimes whether this is a legitimate concern or just obviously I think that the party that's down always asks for nonpartisan redistricting. But, I mean, the real question is what's best for Virginia, and I'm not convinced that the only value at stake here would be I mean, people, the primary reason we have political segregation on seats is people, general country people usually vote Republican, city people generally vote Democratic, and the suburbs swing. It's not rocket science, that's what's happened. You would have to draw districts very carefully for them to be competitive in a place like Charlottesville. So,
David, would you like to respond?
Sure. I'll stop my whining. You know, I've been around here a long time. I've run a lot of elections, a lot of campaigns, and I've governed locally for a long time. I'd like to think that I don't think in a partisan way. There are times that I do, but for the most part, I'm looking out for other things. And some of my votes in the past have gotten me in a little bit of trouble with my own party. So that being said, you know, this is a pretty safe seat, you know, and so to the extent I'm talking about making more competitive seats, I'm hurting myself. So it's not like I'm trying to change the dynamic for me. Now, I think there are other values independent of the competitiveness issue. The contiguous nature of districts has a certain appeal to it also. You don't want to construct these pizza slice districts or the classic case of Eric Cantor's district, his congressional district, the way that was sliced up. But, I mean, think of Senator Deed's district. And that's a fairly good Democratic district. But look how that's configured. It's crazy. He's got a district about the size of, is it New Jersey? He has to drive all the way over to Covington to the far reaches and then over here. I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think nonpartisan redistricting would introduce some of those other values into the mix. And it might not make every district real competitive, but it would make some districts a lot more competitive than they are now, and I think that would be a good thing.
Do you have further comments?
Sure.
I think you
standing up. Toward the end of the session, as the budgets reached the floor, we saw, I think it was approximately $37 million in so-called cultural amendments, arts, music, museums, none of which were things that had been put in the budget originally by either the outgoing or the incoming governor. Some of us would quite frankly call them pork barrel earmarks. I'm just wondering, did you participate in that process? And if you did, what are the earmarks that you're most proud of bringing back to Charlottesville or Albemarle or Greene or Madison?
Who wants to start?
Just make sure there were two bouts of this, and I think I know which one you mean. There's the non-state agencies generally, and then there's that last minute gasp of change in the sofa that the governor found. I assume you mean the first one, not the second. Okay. I know Charlottesville didn't do very well.
Unless you don't count the University of Virginia.
No, I mean in what he's talking about. They're called non-state agencies is what Joe is getting at, and there are a variety of programs ranging from clearly artistic, which is, I think, the general ambit that they proceed under, to some that you would look at and say they're not artistic at all. If you look at which districts did well, it is a very easy connect the dots. It's a seniority-driven system, and it's based on who's on appropriations, and neither of us are.
Not.
We're not. No, we're not. I'm just trying to think if did anybody? I'm not aware of. Did any get in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like the Paramount got some money, and Lewis and Clark Exploratory Museum got some money. But I would think it's fair to say that our role in this process is to we can put in these requests, but reduce is not the right word, but what we do then is go around and lobby our colleagues on appropriations to see if we can finagle a way that they will include the things that we think are important in the budget. So I know I did, and I'm sure Rob did, spend a lot of time talking about a lot of the UVA initiatives that they wanted in this budget. And UVA made out very well. And I'd like to think that some of it has to do with our advocacy for the university. Higher education made out very well. So that's one stage in the budget process. I think I heard Joe reference really another part of the budget process, which came at the very end, and that was something that I alluded to earlier in my comments. Right at the very end of the budget process, Governor Kaine put forward a number of amendments that would have allowed the funding of certain things that were not in the budget. And but some of those were in the Warner budget, and one of them in particular was of interest to me and probably of interest to some of you. That was an initiative for, I think it was $7.5 million that would have gone to Lynchburg to deal with what they call their combined sewer overflow. The combined sewer overflow is a term of art that describes what happens when there's too much rain too fast in Lynchburg, and some of the sewage starts to mix with the water that's flowing into the James River. That was in Governor Warner's budget. It hit the House Appropriations Committee, and it was stripped out of that budget. Interestingly enough, combined sewer overflow money for Richmond was not stripped. There are lots of theories as to why that happened in that way, but it was stripped out of Warner's budget. So at the end, Governor Kaine decided he would try one more time to get it through. Now, this was at the time that we were having these massive rains, and the joke was that while we're on the floor of the House debating this issue, which ultimately we never debated, the sewage is coming out of Lynchburg, going through Albemarle County, through Fluvanna, heading towards Richmond, is going to hit us at about the time we get to vote on it, eventually go to the Chesapeake Bay. We were able to put $200 million into Chesapeake Bay cleanup, but we couldn't find the $7.5 million to help Lynchburg. We never got to vote on that issue because the caucus, the Republican caucus, wouldn't allow a vote, period. The same thing happened with an initiative that I was very interested in, and I know that Delegate Bell is interested in it too. And that was an initiative that would have helped shore up child care funding for working families in Charlottesville, Albemarle. Because of some changes in the state, federal legislation and federal law regarding pass-through monies that were coming to us for child care for working families, the United Way and the local social services agencies were going to be $220-some million short, which meant that they would have to take some people who are working families off of the child care scholarship program, with the result that some people might lose their job. At the very least, they were going to lose their child care. Governor Kaine, at the suggestion of some of us, put in language at the last minute to try to get some of that money back. It wasn't a new appropriation. It was going to only use money if there was a year-end balance. We never got to vote on it. We never got to debate it. We never got to discuss it. Most of the time was spent by the various caucuses coming in and out of the room on that last day. I'd like to have thought that Delegate Bell would support that. I think he's fully conversant with the issue. But we never got a chance to vote on it, and that was a pretty frustrating thing. At least the public has a right to see the votes. We can debate it, decide legitimate arguments, but the public ought to see the votes and then hold their representatives accountable based on those votes. Long-winded.
Did you have an additional comment?
Listen, I take a different view of this. I don't think it'll surprise anybody. There's about three ways to approach this, but let me start at the big one. We had just passed a budget with enormous increases in it. We do a biennial budget. The budget came in at $61 billion. It left at $74 billion. That's the increase over the two-year period. That included, among other things, $200 million for the Chesapeake Bay. For 6 months, we had been told by the governor, by Democrats, Republicans, people back home, people in Northern Virginia, people in Hampton Roads, please stop spending money on everything such that we don't have any left for transportation. And we started with $1 billion. By the time all the money got spent by all the various groups, including the ones that Joe mentioned, we were down to 339. Okay, so less than a third was left for whatever we're going to do this fall with transportation. Now, we then go home, and this is what I called shaking the sofa. The governor found $29 million in more money. Okay, and there was apparently two miscalculations, and I forget what the third part was, but he found $29 million, and he suggested spending it on a variety of programs. These programs included the sewage in Lynchburg that Dave talked about. It included some money for the daycare that he's talking about. It included a Fishkill study in Winchester. It included a museum down in Southside, a park down in Southwest. It included, as I recall, a library at Norfolk State. It included a bunch of, and I'm not going to use the word pork, a bunch of locality-specific programs. And the way locality-specific programs pass and the way all the money goes away is just like what Dave described. I go around to get Charlottesville, it's $244,000. To get that, I have to go to the guy in Norfolk and say, well, gosh, I'll vote you your $2 million for your library if you will support my 244. And step by step, bit by bit, every penny gets spent. Now, you may think, and especially around here, for all of our trouble with transportation, we don't have the trouble they have in Hampton Roads in Northern Virginia. You may say that in the big picture, we would have been better off with that money being spent on some of our locality-specific spending. And the one that, of course, the one that was directly on point for us was the child care. But I mean, let's be clear. We have doubled child care spending in the last 6 years. This is not something that we've not been spending money on. Now, you may think that's not enough. You may think we should have more. But it's doubled in the last 6 years. And we concluded that, we've been talking about trying to save money now for 6 months. Let's save what we can, and let's add the 29 to the 339 and save that for the fall. Is 29 enough to solve the transportation problem? Of course not. It's silly. I mean, it is. They've estimated how much asphalt you can lay with $29 million. But there was a, as Everett Dirksen said, a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money. That's what we're doing. And, you know, the issues you send us down for. When I was a college Republican and knew everything, I assumed that every dollar spent was for something foolish. And what I've concluded is that, like most bills, most ideas are not bad ideas. They're all good ideas, every single one of them. There's not a person in this room, I'm sorry, this area, that couldn't come up right now with $100 million of spending that would do some social good. Seriously, I mean it. Without any work at all, and it would be different. We'd each have our own. We could come up with $100 million. The problem is we all do that, and step by step we spend all the money, and then there's nothing left for what everybody says we have to fix, which in this case is transportation. So that was sort of the backdrop to that.
Any further questions? Yes, sir.
My name is Bob Gibson. I live in the city of Charlottesville, and I've heard a lot about this question in the last several weeks. Should Virginia have a law giving children more rights when it comes to police questioning, interrogation of children by police?
You're both on Courts and Crime.
I think it's fair to say that this is something that we're going to look at. While this, and I'm not trying to hide the ball, everyone knows why this is a topic of some interest in our area. There's been a high-profile case where this was something that came up. On the other hand, for those of us who, former prosecutor, this is not a new issue in the world. This is something that's come up, and the Supreme Court over time has developed a fairly substantial body of law outlining when and when you cannot question a child. And if you care, it's the same general rules of knowing and voluntary waiver of your rights. And, you know, if you're 6 years old, there's probably never going to be a time that you can knowingly and voluntarily waive your rights. If you're 17, you're probably smarter than a lot of 18-year-olds. And so the court applies this standard to when a child's questions will ultimately be admissible. If the police get it wrong, if they question someone who the courts conclude did not voluntarily and knowingly waive his rights, the evidence is suppressed, and so you could have a very serious case where they brought him in and, you know, the parents weren't there, other safeguards or precautions weren't taken, and the evidence would be denied to the court. The case would probably end. It would be an acquittal. That's the black letter law. I think that we need to be very careful to avoid, I'll give you some easy examples. When you apply an absolute rule, you have to be very careful that you're not going to have unintended consequences. In the case here, obviously, I think that the concern is that the statements made somehow led to a miscarriage of justice. If there's a miscarriage of justice and the child was going to say the same things when the parents are there, then it's a question of what the impact that might be. If there's not going to be a difference and if there is going to be a difference when the parents are there, you have to understand what the difference would be. I think that it's fair to say that if you had, cops come in, there's a drinking party, cops come in, somebody's lying dead on the floor, cops come in and start asking questions, it really will matter the rules you apply. And if the goal is to try and get to the bottom of what happened, you need to be careful you don't do set up rules that will make that impossible.
David, what's your feeling about this? And the other question to follow up with Bob's is, do you think you're going to hear about this issue in Courts and Crimes, and what are you going to do about it if it gets there?
Well, I think we're definitely going to hear about it, because who knows, one of us might introduce a bill. And, you know, one of the great things about the House of Delegates, and especially of all the committees that I've seen, I think courts may be the least partisan. And that's, you know, and you are in a great position, because there are two sections to courts. One is the criminal section to courts, and they deal with all the criminal bills, and Rob's on that committee. And then there's the civil section of courts. That's everything having to do from medical malpractice to a lot of civil laws. That comes through a subcommittee that I'm on. And then we get together and we thrash it out again if these bills percolate through the subcommittee system. So I think that, you know, a bill like this is likely to end up in Rob's subcommittee and in the committee as a whole. Simple statement, I think children need to have more rights, and I think parents need to have more rights. Now, it gets much more complicated once you start going past the simple statement. One issue has to do is whether a child is in custody or not. You know, you got to be careful. If a child's in custody, it's pretty clear that they need to be told more about their rights, and that I think parents ought to be brought in as an option to be in the room while they're interrogated. After all, they're being detained. It's like they're arrested. They can't leave the room. And some of the courts find that rights don't attach at that point. But I think we have an obligation to look at that issue again. Now, if a child is not in custody and there is a discussion, a questioning, then it really gets dicey. If a CSO, a community service officer, is doing the questioning, is that an interrogation that would implicate the whole system, where you have to make the parents aware, you got to give the child a right to a lawyer? What if it's a social service worker who is investigating some child protective service case? What if it's just a teacher? What if it's a school bus driver? How many times we hear about school bus drivers during the last session? So it gets very complicated. I think part of what we do as the deliberative process in the House of Delegates is to ferret out all the complexities of laws that are coming to us. Hopefully we do a good job. Sometimes we make a mistake and we have to go back and correct it. But I think everybody on Courts of Justice is genuinely concerned with getting it right and taking it the time to do so. We'll be looking at this thing, I think, in the next session.
Jane, could I comment on that just real quick? And I'll be quick, because I know that other people want to say some things. Something Dave said that I think is important. If you want to watch and come down and see something I think you'd find edifying, I would also recommend you come to the Courts Committee. And I don't know, it may be that 10 years from now it'll be the worst committee, but right now I think you have some of the brighter people down there. I do think we really try and look at the right things. And so whatever the bill is, we're going to look at balancing some issues that are important, like how can we preserve the prevent miscarriages of justice? How can we stop kids from being wrongfully accused? Okay, that's over here. How can we make sure that when you have a very dangerous case or something you need to find out, you don't restrain law enforcement, police, prosecutors, some of the other people that might have some information like they've described, to make sure that you don't make it impossible for these cases to be brought? I mean, most adults who aren't – Jim's going to laugh. Jim is our public defender, everybody. Most adults who are brought in and confess to the police officers probably shouldn't, if their interests are to not be put in jail. I mean, you may have this mental image that it always works like CSI, and in fact, the vast majority of cases are eyewitness testimony and someone's statement that they make to the police. That's what most of these cases are. And so I think that that has to be the backdrop to a discussion about what we're going to do, because if you think that cases will be made whether or not the kids make statements or not, in most cases that is in fact what the evidence consists of.
My name is Howard Pape. I live in Alamo County. I thought a lot about this, and I have almost come to the conclusion that the two-party system really is the problem. I think it's most evident on the national level, but you can certainly see it here in Virginia, that while you guys share, while you have obvious divergent ideological beliefs, you do share one belief in common, and that is that the size of the government just couldn't possibly be big enough. And some examples in Virginia are, I think I would say the marriage ban amendment, someone suggesting a year or so ago about a law about how high you have to keep your pants pulled up or the width of a corridor in an abortion clinic. There's no end to it. And while you both proudly share the legacy of Thomas Jefferson's seat, he believed in limited government. So my question is, aside from saying, well, we're trying to stop spending so much money because it goes way beyond that, it's pushing your ideological beliefs on us, which of you is really going to have the courage to stand up for what Thomas Jefferson believed in, which is less intrusive government? Thank you.
David, would you like to take that first? Because I think Rob spoke last.
Well, I'd like to think that the positions that I've taken over time are supportive of less intrusive government. I've always been pro-choice. I've always taken, I voted against the marriage amendment. Now, if you take a look at some other things, you might not consider that to my positions to be supportive of less intrusive government. For example, I'm interested in spending more money on education. Is that less intrusive? I think that's consistent with Jefferson's view. Jefferson believed that democratic process only works with an educated citizenry and created the University of Virginia as a result, nurtured that university. And I think the public expenditures of money for universities and public education makes a great deal of sense. So, you know, limited government, I don't know where you take it. For me, it's always been a balance. You know, when I was here in the city, we took the position that we were not going to expand our workforce because we just felt it wasn't sustainable economically. In the House of Delegates, I'm always looking at, I'm not on appropriations, but if I was, I'd be looking at the issue of how do you sustain the spending that you approve year after year after year. If you can't sustain it, you shouldn't be spending it. That's why when some of these proposals came at us to use one-time monies in the budget for long-term transportation projects that would be spent over a period of years, I couldn't support it because it wasn't a sustainable source of revenue. That's why Governor Kaine has insisted that if you're going to solve this transportation problem, you have to have a long-term sustainable source of revenue. So I think in conclusion, it's not simply saying, oh, I'm going to be the champion of less intrusive government. I think it's always a balance. I'd like to think that, at least I've tried to strike the appropriate balance, and people are going to judge me on my votes and my positions as whether I've done so.
Rob, you have some comments?
I think that different people probably see government intrusion in different places, and I'll give some easy examples. I think there are some people, and I probably share this belief, that see the rise in the growth of spending as a steady diminution of individual rights because you're taking money from people and choosing to spend it for them. That's taxes. You have property rights issues, and I think that we failed this last year to come up with a real property rights protection in wake of the Kelo decision. I think that at the federal level, I know that civil libertarians are very concerned about, or people who believe them, I think everyone calls themselves civil libertarians, but some people who call themselves civil libertarians are concerned about the Patriot Act. I think that if you look at the Libertarian Party platform, there are issues with regards to laws against drug use. There's actually an argument on abortion, but some other sort of police laws that they feel are unduly restrictive of their personal liberty. You know, we take these up. David and I both have ideologies. What I mean is we're not coming to this with a blank slate and have never thought about any of these issues before, but I do try and take them up on a one-by-one basis. And so, you know, the one that concerns me most is spending. And the growth in spending during my tenure has not been something that anybody who is fiscally conservative would be very proud of. I mean, it has gone from 47 to 51, from 51 to 61, from 61 to 74. That's in 5 years. And I voted against the biggest of those jumps because that was when we had the big tax increase. This year, I was one of the advocates against higher taxes. So, you know, by my lights, if that's something that's important, that's something I think was an accomplishment. But looking at the big picture, you can't say going from 47 to 74 was by any means something that if you'd started from scratch and said, gosh, if we elect a bunch of conservatives, they'll keep spending down. It's gone from 47 to 74. So I share some of your thoughts, but I think that I guess I would take the issues one by one. I mean, you know, ironically, David, I think if you stacked up all the votes, would be considered one of the more, I don't know how you do this, but one of the more liberal Democrats. And I would be one of the, you know, conservative Republicans, but I'm not sure how that answers directly what you're asking. But I do understand your question.
Yes, Jim, would you like to use the microphone?
I'm Jim Hingley, and I live in Charlottesville. We have a local circuit court judge whose term is going to expire during the next session of the legislature. And the appointment will be made during the legislative session that will have a big impact on this community. So my question is, what process do you envision for the selection of a circuit judge in this community? And to what extent will the minority party have a role to play in that selection?
You want me to
may I ask a question? Is it true that Virginia and South Carolina are the only two states in the union that actually have judges appointed by the legislature? Elected by the legislature.
I don't know. Maybe so. Interesting. I don't think there's going to be a bill to change that in Virginia, though. Let me say, my position on this, ironically, is the position of a former Republican legislator, Paul Harris. Paul Harris, many years ago, when there was an opening for a judgeship, took the position that we should not have the judgeship chosen behind closed doors by a small number of people, that we should have a totally open, totally transparent process that involves distinguished members of the community, not just from the legal community, and at the end of the process, whoever bubbles to the top should get the strong support of the legislative contingent from this area in Richmond to get appointed. It would be my position that we ought to embrace that process, that we ought to do it right in the front end so that everybody knows what we're doing, and so that when we go down to the legislature, Delegate Bell, myself, the other members of this delegation who are involved in that circuit, will be fully behind that candidate, and that person will slide through the General Assembly.
Rob, how about commenting? And then I have a follow-up question as well.
Just so everybody knows the formality of the process, what happens is each judicial circuit, and I don't know how many there are, but they consist of 8 or 9 counties. We are in the 16th Judicial Circuit. It has Albemarle, Charlottesville, Nelson, Orange, Madison, Green. It goes all the way up to Goochland. What happens is every legislator who has a piece, even just one little precinct of that district, is part of the judicial district search. And so we have in our district, I think it's 4, I might get this wrong, there are 12 total members, 6 Senate, 6 House, and I think there are 8 Republicans, or 7 Republicans, 1 independent, and 4 Democrats, if you're keeping score. And what we do is the district's choice is given a very strong deference by the general body. I can't think of a time that the delegates from Botetourt overrode the delegates from someplace else because they just didn't like them. And so, and that's for obvious reasons. We don't all have time to review each and every candidate, aside from just basic criteria of whether they have passed the bar and haven't been arrested for something, which is what we do on the Courts of Justice Committee. Last time I've done it two ways. I've been involved with a long and thoughtful process, and then one that was kind of quick and as quick as it could be. And it relates to the level of the court. We have circuit courts here, and the circuit court is the high court. That's where you have a jury. The circuit court is where you have death penalty cases. It's where you have cases of $10 million. The big libel case we had a few years ago with Channel 29, that was a circuit court case. Without demeaning the traffic court or the juvenile court justices and judges in any way, the circuit court judges is where the rubber meets the road. That's the single most important judge, arguably, in the entire United States, because many of his decisions are ultimately not reviewable. Now, they go to the Supreme Court, but the decisions he makes are very important. And so I do think that we should be careful with every judge we do. And so we appointed a district court judge, and he was, I think, unanimously supported. He was out of Goochland. But I think that it is especially important that we get the circuit court judges right. The last time I did this, we had an opening when the judge in Orange, Judge Sullenberger, I think he was having some health issues, but I think he retired. I don't think he had to stop in midterm. We had public forum. I appointed a group of five citizens of varying backgrounds to listen to the comments of various people. I took recommendations, and I took that down to Richmond with me. And ultimately, there was the 12 members of the General Assembly in the district got together, and he was chosen. Judge Sander was chosen. This time I would like to do the same thing. I haven't made a final decision, in part because I will know some of the applicants personally, probably. And so if I have worked with someone for a year, in all honesty, that's going to have some weight beyond what, you know, a 20-minute presentation they make at a meeting. And so I'm probably going to have I plan to have some sort of judicial committee. I know that the Bar Association is going to have a judicial committee. But then I'm not trying to hide the ball or disguise this from anybody. If they have someone who's politically connected through the bar and he gets a ringing endorsement, and I know because I've known him for years that he's going to make a rotten judge, I'm not going to support him. And this is the great benefit of having someone that's in court every day. The downside is obviously that's going to be partially weighted on what I think is important. So those are my thoughts.
David, did you weigh in on that one? You did. Okay. Could we have one more question? Josh says he wants to wrap this up since we can no longer see one another. So could we have...
My question, of course, has to do with the fact that such a few people participating in elections, and it indicates that that is something basically or fundamentally wrong with the system that we like to prize as being the greatest system in the world. We find even other systems out of this state and nation where you have more people actually participating. Now, I think that you may need to start at the local level, the state level in particular, and I would like to know what are your concerns as relates to this issue. What are you going to do about it? So we can have just about in any election, 75% of the people actually voting. Now, 75% of the people go to the grocery store. 75% of the people go to school with the children. You have a high number of people going to church. And in some groups, you have a high number of the people going to jail. So I wonder, what can you do to help to get more people participating? It seems to me that much of what it's done is to exclude people. Exclude them because they say they're felons. And if a person has served his time in prison, why can't? Matter of fact, you ought to say, one way to be a good citizen, I'm going to help you to vote. So what are you going to do about that kind of a thing?
Okay. I'm going to toss this right back, and I'll tell you why. I think that the reason voting is down is that when you shop at a grocery store and you see advertisements on TV and you see the chairman of Food Lion, the chairman of Giant Foods, talking about their product, they don't sit there and say that the president of Food Lion is a crook. They don't say that. But I mean, in other words, if you look at the way political discourse is carried, we demonize each other in a very personal way. And how could you not be turned off? I mean, if you had Tide and somebody else in the Tide, I don't know, ERA, whatever the latest detergents are, they said Cheer. Okay, if the maker of Tide said Cheer caused cancer, and the maker of Cheer said yes, but Tide will make your fingers turn blue and they'll be shriveled up and horrible, over time people wouldn't use either. And I think what has happened over time is, as I sit here and call Dave a crook, not someone who's a little bit wrong, not someone who's smart but has a different background, not someone who has a good idea but maybe not this year, but I call him a crook, a scoundrel, a racist, whatever words are the ones on the tip of your list, I think voters just stay home. They go, a pox on both of you. Because then he calls back and says, Bell represents the rich or the hateful or the xenophobes or whatever. And I really think that's why turnout is down. I think that over time, if you do this year after year after year, we demean the process and we demonize each other in a very specific way. And unless we all sort of really try and focus on issues because there are differences in issues, and I think they're important differences, and some of them will come up tonight. That's fine. Call me knucklehead. I mean it. I mean, when I make mistakes, I don't mind the bad mail. But please, it's not my motives are not awful, and neither are Dave's. And so I think that in the long run, if you really want to increase the public polity in a positive way, talk about issues, get the vote out, work in politics, but try to not demonize the opponents that don't deserve it. That's my thoughts.
And over and above the train.
Yeah, I agree. We shouldn't demonize folks. I think, you know, a lot of people with much better minds than the two of us have been working on this for a long time. A lot of groups around the Sorensen Institute, Center for Politics, trying to get people involved younger. But, you know, we go on the campaign trail. We work our tails off. You know, we knock on lots of doors. And it's very discouraging to us when people don't come out and vote. You know, it's probably more complicated than folks calling each other's names. Sometimes it's just the issues. They just haven't gotten a hold of the issues. You know, in the Lamont-Lieberman race, a primary, what the voter turnout was over 55% or something like that. It was more than in the gubernatorial race, Tim Kaine and Jerry Kilgore. What does that say? So, you know, I'm sorry, we don't have the answers. All we can do is keep plugging away, keep talking to each other. You know, we're not in the same district, but we are in the same building. So, you know, you get one-stop shopping if you come to visit us. He's upstairs. I'm downstairs. He can use my conference room if you want to meet there.
Thank you all for being here. It is true. They do share a building. I'd like to thank Josh and the TJ Center for the Protection of Free Expression for inviting me to participate in this evening. It was wonderful seeing you all here as well. I hope to hear from you on the morning show tomorrow morning. Call in and tell me on the QT how you think everybody did. And thank you, too, very, very much for giving up your evening and joining us and being so forthright.
You've been listening to Delegates Rob Bell and David Toscano talking with constituents on the Downtown Mall at the Community Chalkboard and Podium, a program of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. For more events in the series, keep checking back at cvillepodcast.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, public affairs programming supported in part by Flying Dog Media. For your next website design, visit flyingdogmedia.com. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.